Here is one of a series of talks by spiritual leader Lola McDowell Lee, spanning two decades from the early 70s through the 90s. Lola was a Zen Roshi whose Rinzai lineage included Dr. Henry Plutov and renowned Zen master Shigetsu Sasaki. Lola was a religious scholar as well as an ordained Christian minister. While the talks are focused mainly on Zen and Buddhism, Lola drew on many spiritual traditions, including those of Jesus, Plato, Lao Tzu, the Hindu Vedas, Meister Eckhart, and Gurdjieff.
So we still have the Upanishads, and we may have two more lessons, maybe one only. Let's see what happens when I get into it. Let's see. Okay. Into a blind darkness they enter who follow after the non-birth. They, as if into a greater darkness, who devote themselves to the birth alone. Other, verily, it is said, is that which comes by the birth. Other that which comes by the non-birth. This is the lore we have received from the wise who revealed that to our understanding. He who knows that as both in one, the birth and the dissolution of birth, by the dissolution crosses beyond death, and by the birth enjoys immortality. The face of truth is covered with a brilliant golden lid. That do thou remove, O fosterer, for the law of truth, for sight. There was a teacher out of India at one time who spoke of the Hindu way of life, and he called it a life negative. And he said this because of the Hindu religion, and not all alone Hindu religions, a lot of them, that the religion taught a rejection, as it were, of life, that there is this great renunciation of life. And we don't leave that just entirely in India, because we have individually, you know, we have the subtle little signs within us of the same, you know. Every now and then we seem to enjoy a hair shirt situation. We tend now and then to punish ourselves. See, we're life negative. Some people more than others, of course. Some people spend a whole lifetime trying to punish themselves and feeling guilty. Now, what we call God does exist in this world. It's in this manifest world as well as the unmanifest world, in the seen world as well as the unseen world, you know. And so when you reject this manifestation, what are you rejecting? If we reject this world, let us say, hardly anybody does this, but a flower. Well, dandelions we reject now and then. And some of the weeds do have little flowers on them. Weeds we reject, which is nothing but a misplaced plant, somebody once said. But when you reject something like that, we also reject what it is becoming. You know. So then we can add, we stand there and look at it. What is it becoming? If everything is God becoming, as it says in this Upanishad, then we are rejecting God if we reject the weed, the flower. I guess I'll let my weeds grow. We reject each other. And this, of course, is more to the point. And this, what the Upanishads calls the Purusha, here and here, he am I. You know, that's what you're rejecting. In some religious movements, we are taught, too bad, but we are taught to feel guilt. You know, we feel guilty about loving. We feel guilty about life itself. And we feel guilty about laughter. And we're taught to feel guilty if we feel joyous or if we're cheerful. You know, we're supposed to have this long, pious face, you know, to be religious. And so then we're guilty if we enjoy food, you know, if we enjoy friendships, if we enjoy any kind of a relationship, we're supposed to feel guilty. Guilty for everything that you enjoy. And so they have these commandments and these precepts that are imposed upon us, and there is not much enjoyment for us in these, all of thou shalt nots and thou shalt. And then, of course, we could also say we don't really understand the commandments or these precepts. They go much deeper than what we think on the surface. And it's interesting, too, what we do with guilt. And we all have had it, or we have it. What do we do with it if we have it? What did we do with it if we had it? You know. So the next time you feel guilty about something, that you enjoyed something that our puritanical cultural background says, but this is a no-no. You know. Look at, and you feel guilty. Look at what you do with it. Because whatever it is that you do with it is what you are in a habit of doing with it. With some, when they begin to feel guilty, when they feel guilty about something, they feel it's their own nature about which they feel guilty. Because you did this no-no, whatever it was, and maybe not a no-no as far as life itself was concerned at all, but the way we're reared sometimes, a no-no. You begin to reject yourself because that your very nature would allow you to do such a thing. Heaven forbid. This rejection of oneself, you know, which is a kind of a slow way of a psychic suicide. Yeah. We go around sad and we're drained and life doesn't have any flavor to it. And, you know, where can we go to get rid of this guilt? And I think this country has an awful lot of it, people in this country, because there are so many therapists. And people are very busy getting rid of their guilts. Or their rejections. No. But then we become obsessed with certain ideas. And maybe then after that, why we begin to fear life and we are ill. And this life, of course, what does life encompass? It encompasses death. So now we've got a bear by the tail, as the saying goes. We must get rid of birth and death. See, we must get rid of our coming and going into this existence. And so some people, on hearing about meditation, they go out and they learn a method, not because they want to know something about themselves, but because they want to escape. They don't want any more of this world. Let me out. It's not a very good attitude, you know, to do something like meditation to us as an escape mechanism. Now, a long time ago, 2,500 years ago or something like that, there was a man by the name of, they finally called him Buddha because he was awake, Siddhartha, Gautama, Shakyamuni. He said, life is suffering. And in a way, it's true. We have a great deal to contend with. Goodness sakes, huh? When, for the first time, the Buddha sat down to teach, he had these four disciples, these four men. And he said to them, the first truth is the fact of suffering. All of us, we all want happiness. We want what is good. We want what is pleasant. We want to be good. We want to be pleasant. We want what is right. We want something permanent. We want something joyful. We want something harmonious, satisfying, something that is at ease. We want to be with ease at life. And yet we find that life brings us just the opposite. It brings a lot of frustration and a lot of dissatisfaction, and it certainly is not complete. There's an incompleteness about it. And there's suffering and there's sorrow. Mom. Life is change. And it is indeed, life is change. And change can never satisfy desire. Everything that changes brings suffering, he said. And then he went on and he said, the second truth is the cause of suffering. It is not life that brings sorrow, but the demands that we make of life. The cause of suffering is selfish desire. The thirst to have what I want and then to get my own way, you know? And then thinking that life can make us happy by bringing us what we want, people running after the satisfaction of their desires, and they run and they run and they run, you know. And yet we find that this desire only brings sorrow. And he went on to say, there is no fire like selfish desire. Not 100 years of experience can put it out. I mean, should you live 100 years, do you think your desire would be different, but would it be any less at the end of 100 years than it was in the first 20? Different, but still there, huh? So 100 years of experience can't extinguish it. The more you feed it, the more it burns. Desire demands what experience cannot give. It wants permanent pleasure, unmixed with anything unpleasant. Yeah. But there is an end to such desire. That is the nature of the mind. You know, selfish desire is like, you know, is this suffering. And we suffer for such things that a banana tree doesn't have mangoes. This is selfish desire. Now, then there is a third truth. Any ailment that can be understood can be cured. Suffering that has a cause also has an end. when the fires of selfishness have been extinguished, when the mind is free of selfish desire, what remains? Now, see, you've wiped away all this desire, this selfish desire, out of your mind. What remains then, see, is a state of wakefulness. It's peace and it's joy. And it is called that which is extinguished, or nirvana. That's where they get a nihilistic point of view about nirvana, which it isn't, of course. What remains is wakefulness. You can't be annihilated and be awake. The fourth truth, he said, is that selfishness can be extinguished by following the Noble Eightfold Path, which is, you know, right understanding, right purpose, right speech, right conduct, right occupation, right effort, right attention, and right meditation. Right? Mm-hmm. Right. Correct. And then he goes on to say, if Dharma is a wheel, and the Buddhists look upon it as a wheel, Dharma is a wheel, then these are the spokes, these different, the right attitude, right mind, so on and so on. See, I could have branched out and given a whole thing on that today, couldn't I? And we could go on with the Upanishad another couple months. Anyway, that's more or less a translation of the Dhammapada. Now, if you listened, and that's hard to do, none of the above said anything about dying to get out of it. What it said was, end desire. Away with it. Do something about it, this desire. And he said, you know, look for a way. Look for a way. There is an end, there is a way to end suffering. If one suffers until one has what we call conquered the pseudo-self or the ego, one suffers until one becomes the true self, and this is the, shall we say, the area, the realm, the level where this becoming being is to take place. Yeah. And then this, as you know, this Upanishad states, one should wish to live 100 years. With desire ending, one should wish to live 100 years, not coveting, not lusting after any man's possessions. Pretty marvelous thing, huh? Be like that. Living, you know, in this non-attachment and this non-desiring state. Rabindranath, you know, the great poet of India, when he lay dying, and he had this very good friend that hovered over him, and this friend kept saying to him, pray to God, pray to God, you know, pray to God that this should be your last life. And this dying man, you know, he opened his eyes, dying, and he looks at this friend, and then as if he was talking to a very small child, he says, I am praying to God. And I am saying, God, your life has been such a beautiful gift. I would like to have another such. I would like to come back and see the sunrise, and see the sunset, and see the starry night, and see the flowers, and to see a bird on wing, and hear its song, to see the green trees, to see your rivers, and your mountains, and your people. I would like to come again, to see this vastness, the inexhaustible process of nature. So will he return? He had the desire. Yeah. in India, and of course, to a certain extent, all of us. And, you know, certain beliefs. I was baptized a Lutheran, and they do have a certain belief of preordination. It's fate, you see. And so in India, it's rampant there, you know. It's fate, and nothing can be done about it. It's a little different than it is in the Lutheran church, but it's fate. God has so decided you belong to such and such a caste, how they have enlarged on this thing, you know. Not even a leaf falls from the tree without the will of God. We can do nothing. We simply accept our fate that he has chosen for us. You know. Well, look what happened to India. They're nice people. They're very kind people, nice, soft-spoken people. And they mostly live in poverty, except for the few of the upper crust. Most of them have had very little education. And they are now beginning to stir and to look around and see what the rest of the world is doing. This just accepting, you know, the lifespan was very short there, like 28 years. And if one has always the attitude that nothing can be done about it, there's nothing you can do about it. And it's true, some things nothing can be done about it. I cannot grow 10 inches. I may want to, but I can't grow 10 inches. I mean, this I have to accept, you know. And I have to get a permanent to get curly hair. Yeah. But to have that apply to everything. There's nothing I can do about it. Nothing I can do about it. You know, pretty soon one gets lazy. One gets sloppy. There's nothing I can do about it anyway. What are you going to do? Nothing, you know. You know, you're not responsible, so, you know, whatever happens, it just had to happen. And if I am like I am, why, maybe next time I'll be lucky. That was my mother, too. She was 4'11". I got her beat a little bit. But she'd say always, you know, when I come back again, if there is such a thing, and I come back again, I want to work for the government because that's security, and I'm going to be tall so I can reach things on shelves. Yeah. Next time we may be lucky and be born in another caste. Next time maybe we could be born a Brahmin. You know, that's the top of the line. And this is India, with their poverty, and their starvation, and their illness, undernourished. They say that 60% of the people are starving. And who's doing anything about it? Of course, now, of course, they are. There's movements and committees to help. And all these problems that they have, about which they say nobody can do anything about because it's God's will. And the Hindus go on sitting, worshiping the elephant god Ganesha, or the monkey god Hanuman, or the holy mother cow. And they pray to them, you know, these elephants, these monkeys and the cows, that somehow they're going to help them out of their predicament. Yeah. And India is one of the great cradles of great religion. The religion almost isn't understood there. They misinterpret it, which we are very apt to do. We do it ourselves. We are very apt to do until we know what it is that is observing. What is it in you that knows? When you know that, then you don't misinterpret. But until that time you do. I venture to say you're misinterpreting what I say, even. I have found that very often. In India, you know, one seeks, and as a small child also, they go and live with a guru, and then they come back and become a householder and get married and so on and so on. But if one is really seeking, he goes to a guru, a teacher, who lives in the forest or he lives by the banks of a river, and he is taught brahmacharya, celibacy. That is not to touch a woman, for man is not to touch a woman, and a woman is not to touch a man. So what happens? We have lots of repression, and we have lots of rejection. And out of that, what comes? Sure, it goes down, it comes up again, repressed, obscenity. The Kama Sutra was written about 3,000 years ago, and it is a very descriptive of the many aspects of sex. It's a good porno book. Yeah. And our porno magazines and pictures and so on, they say, are a sign of our times. We have repressed so much, it's got to come out. It's like a boil coming to a head. And there are temples. Which one did you go to, Dottie?
There are
80 of them left now. Okay. I had heard at one time there were 1,000, but there was about 100 left. Okay, and there's some others in Puri, and there's in Konarak. This brahmacharya, which is supposed to be the highest goal for humanity, because we're androgynous then. You know, you recall the story of Isis and her son Horus and looking for the father, and they found all his parts except his genitals. No more sex, you see, brahmacharya. And of course, you know, in the Christian Bible, it also says there are no marriages in heaven. No. You think about it. So this rejection in India, this brahmacharya, this celibacy, and then out comes all this sculpture, these temples, all these figures on it, obscene. See?
I'm very happy.
You know, nowhere else are there temples like there are in India. You know, if you're ever fortunate enough to be invited to Dottie's house, you run in her kitchen real quick, and she's got a sample of Maggie up there that she brought back from India. Yeah. Just think, 80 temples. Whole city full of temples. And all of the sculpting is obscene. Anyway, this brahmacharya, this celibacy, how misunderstood it has been. There was at one time a teacher, and he had an ashram in India, and he had a number of young men as disciples. And some of you know this story. And one day he called two of them aside, and he sent them on an errand in a distant town. And they left, they accomplished the errand, and they're on their way back when they came to this river. And there had been a flood, and it had torn away the bridge, so there was no way to get across the river unless you waded. Now, it was not deep, but it was flood wide. And on the bank of this river, there is this very, very lovely girl, about 18 or so. Huh? She's very sexy, very lovely, and obviously wants to get across this river. Now, one of the disciples, he didn't even want to talk to her, you know, he averted his eyes and said, you know, he's practicing celibacy. And the other one, he goes to her and finds that she's on her way. She's all dressed in her finery. She's on her way to her engagement in this next town. And she doesn't know how to get across this river. So this disciple, he turns to this Brahmacharya disciple and says, "We can help her across. We'll make a chair out of our arms and we'll wade across and she'll be okay." So this is finally what they did. And they carried her over, put her down, and they went on their way and she went on hers. Now this was sometime in the morning. Later in the afternoon, they settled under a tree to rest a little bit and to have something to eat. And this one disciple who is practicing celibacy says, "How am I ever going to face our guru knowing that I have touched a woman? I have not been true to the brahmacharya state." And this other little disciple, he looks at him, he says, "Are you still carrying her?" We do live with our delusions, and we do live in our states of attachment. Now we can look at this brahmacharya in quite a different way. A person, let us say, is very one-pointed. That is, a person is very mindful. Mindful. What they are interested in is knowing. So the main interest is to cross the river to the other shore. You cross one shore, of course, is ignorance, and the other one is knowledge. So we're crossing from one shore to the other shore. And so we practice meditation, and we have no thought, no concept, no word in your mind. It is mindful. And the self, with a capital S, self is present, not the ego and its demands. The observer, that which observes, you know, is simply observing with no comment. It doesn't say a word, no comment, no thought, no images. This true self, all alone, one alone, that's brahmacharya. One alone, celibate, one alone. See, let's not demand all the time that the cart be before the horse. Celibacy of mind, celibacy of the self. Mind only, and it's pure and it's crystal clear. There's no gobbledygook in it whatsoever. It is not involved with anything. With anything. The Buddha, when he started out, he went into the forest to seek. He wanted to know what life was all about. What is life and what is death? What is it that is going on here? You know, that's a pretty important question. I don't think we ask it very often, but he was determined. What is it that's going on here? What is it with me? What is it with you? What is it with people? What are we doing here? What purpose do we have? Because he had... he was already married, and his father had never let him away out of the palace grounds. His father had been told when the Buddha was born that he would either be a very great king or a very great enlightened one. So the father wanted him to be a king. What's this enlightenment business? It's for the birds. They sit out there in orange robes and beg for food. Who needs that? Be a king. But then one day, this prince and his attendant, his comrade, they left And they call it the four gates. He went out of one gate, and he saw illness, and he went out of another gate, he saw poverty. And there are four gates, and the fourth one is death. He saw a dead man for the first time. And all of these gates upset him terribly, but the death most of all. You know, everything that we do, and it's all going to nothing. So I want to know what this is about. This is what meditation is for, so you'll know what all of this is about. So he goes into the forest, and there, of course, are these teachers all practicing asceticism. You know, and so, of course, he does too. This is the way he's trained. It's the way they've been trained, and the way they've been trained, and the way they've been trained. And so every day he ate a little less. Finally, he was eating one grain of rice a day. That's all. And in his travels, slow travels to be sure, in this very emaciated state, four men came upon him there in the forest. And they became his disciples because they decided that this emaciation made him a teacher. People, you know, they look for funny things. What do you look for when you look for a teacher? Emaciation? No, thank you. God, I had enough of that, too. Now, in his travels one day, this man, he came to this little stream. And it was just wide enough so that there was a rock in the middle that he had to stand on in order to get over to the other side. And these four men, also emaciated, are following right behind him, these devotees. And Siddhartha Shakyamuni discovered that he was too weak to cross this little stream, that he was actually getting too weak to walk anymore. He'd walk a few steps and he'd rest. And he'd walk a few steps and he'd rest. And he'd walk a few more steps and he would rest. So he sat down right there and he began to take stock of himself. And he was, after all, no dumbbell. And he was a very pragmatic man. And he also began to see, in ruminating, that the tremendous states of meditation, these tremendous experiences that he had had at the beginning when he entered the forest, he no longer had. No. He no longer had the strength to reach these states, let alone to maintain them. He simply couldn't meditate. He couldn't. He didn't have the energy. And then he realized what he'd been doing. And he turned to these disciples and he said, I must have something to eat. And there was a woman that lived near this little stream, and she happened by, and he asked her for something to eat, and she cooked for him for weeks. You know, she saw this inner light that was shining in him, and she took care of him, and gradually, very, very gradually, it was over a period of time, he regained his strength. And those four followers, those devotees, they deserted him. He was no longer religious. You see, we were identified and we get attached to some dumb fool things, you know. We have notions and we believe in our notions. And these are the very things we must divest our minds of, and that's why they talk about brahmacharya. Yeah. Divest your mind of your delusions. You know, it is difficult with a deluded mind to see the truth. Yeah. Now, this, what is called the self, the true self, which in Buddhism is called the no self. Yeah. It is the true self, the self in nature, that is becoming. It is the self in the eyes by which you see. It is the self in the ears so that you hear. It is in the touch It is in all the changing states and changing forms. It enters all these states of becoming. It does. So in Buddhism, they call it eye consciousness and ear consciousness and taste consciousness, you know. This is called, this one, you know, that it seems to hit something in us and it splits it out, self out like that, so into the senses. And this is called birth in nature. We're born. This self is in us. Eye consciousness, ear consciousness. This self is also in us in a state of non-becoming because it is unchangeable. It doesn't move, even though it moves. It doesn't move. So we can say in a way that there are these two positions, although it isn't really factual, but it seems to be the way it is. There are these two positions, the self in nature and the self in transcending. The moving in the motion, you know, this universal motion, the moving within that, and yet very quietly seated and not moving. You can see it both ways. And through your meditation, you will see it both ways. See, it is very active in the development of this birth in nature, not itself, the birth in nature. And in our eating of the fruits of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And then also in the eating of the fruit of the tree of life. It is either being active, we can see it being very active, or we can see it as the witness. These are the two states that are possible to human existence. This is the birth and the non-birth. Born into this world, and with our suffering that we bring upon ourselves, we are looking for a way out. We can and we should come to that position in which we feel tranquil because the self, you see, is in its motionless state. It is in its transcending state. So that we become tranquil and we have this blissful state of consciousness where we feel free, where we feel liberated in this movement. That consciousness that is never born and never dies, so it is a non-birth. It is a not of birth, and that's in the ego sense, you see. The dissolution of this ego sense brings us to this non-birth. And non-birth, then, is the dissolution of the birth. Okay? Everybody got it? I'm not going through it again. This birth and this non-birth are not physical conditions. Except, of course, of coming into this world is a physical condition. But the birth that they're speaking of is this consciousness in this form, this consciousness as a vehicle, in a manner of speaking, in which to move around, to become consciousness states, soul states, if you wish. One is liberated from the birth when the non-birth occurs. See, the non-birth occurs when the action of the mind has been exhausted. That is, you've with the desire of it. One can attach oneself to the ego sense. One that is by which we are saying one can attach oneself to the birth. And we do. We desire. This is attaching yourself to the birth. We also have the trap of misunderstanding words such as karma and its concomitant reincarnation. I must do this so-and-so and so-and-so to get rid of my karma, even though I do not know what my karma is. I must get rid of it. And you know, I lived 3,000 years ago. What did I do then that I reap the benefits now? What kind of benefits am I reaping now? Am I reaping the good or am I reaping the bad? Well, if the bad is all nothing but what I desire, then what I am is reaping the good, huh? Anyway. Am I getting punished? Am I being punished or am I receiving rewards? Now, I want to know. How much of what I reap, how much of the pleasure that I have in this life is actually karma? How much of the bad things that are happening in my life is my karma or is just my present desire? You got to be able to chop this up pretty fine, you know. We've got to look at this thing. If one attaches oneself to such a notion, you better look twice. A little harder, huh? The ego principle, the ego looks at it all the time. The ego wants to be clothed in the mental and physical forms. So it looks to this karma. The karma is ego-based. What else? It is, in a manner of speaking, a way of keeping oneself on the wheel of going around and around and around and around. Right? You agree with me? You don't agree? Agree with me? Sure you do. Now, attachment. And we should look at our attachments. You know, attachment is an act of ignorance. We become attached to something either because it gives us a kind of a security or we like it, we desire it. It's ignorance. It's in out of this ignorance. Now, if one remains so attached, you know, so glued to something all the time, that its end is this blind darkness that the Upanishads speak about. Attachments and identification. These are problems to be looked at. What am I attached to? And as things come along, look, you know, I'm attached to this. Why? I'm identified with this. Oh, please do look at your identifications. Very difficult, but please do look at them. Why am I identified with this? It says something about you, doesn't it? Your identifications. Wouldn't you think? Wouldn't you think? Yes, sure, of course. So there's something there to be looked at, some kind of a problem. And not just because I mention it today, but you're going to look at it tomorrow, and tomorrow, and tomorrow, and tomorrow. Attachment, identification, ego problems. And it is surprising we will do most anything to keep it going. Around and around and around. Yeah. It's very subtle. And so unaware are we at times. Most of the time. We just follow where it leads. You know, its little blinking light, the will-o'-the-wisp. Yeah. Now, there are those who think that attachment to this non-birth, you know, is an emphasis to go into a void. And one thinks then, well, this is transcending. But there is such a thing as a nihilistic void. The attempt to annul. You know, when you try to blank out your mind, You're annulling something. You're supposed to ignore what's going on in your mind, not blank it out. Just to ignore it, you know. You don't want to get rid of your mind, for God's sakes. So this nihilistic void that's trying to annul something is looking to the opposite of birth, and it is calling it a non-birth, but it is not a release from the ego. It is a trap. Attachment to one's birth in this body, attachment to it. We do this so easy. We are so attached. This is me. This is me. This attachment is a constant self-limiting thing. If we too attach, it takes long, long rounds to satisfy the ego with no release. And then, of course, we also have, we find a state of ignorance which is devoid, utterly devoid, of any impulse to release. Just not interested. It's not an error in grasping after truth. You know, we can make mistakes there. But it is a perpetual contentment with a state here of blindness. To be perfectly content in ignorance. It can't lead to a greater good because it in this ignorance it doesn't have the slightest notion. It doesn't even dream anything of a higher good. Just satisfied with what they are. Period. No. To realize the self, the true self, not the pseudo-self, that ego, which is an agent for the self, but to realize the self, to go behind the ego, as it were, and see this self as unborn and undying. It is an equilibrium. It is that point of unmoving of the soul. It is beyond the dualities of birth and death. And it is in a transcendental existence. And it is the condition of a free life in this becoming. Then the being is in the becoming. Here we are becoming, becoming, becoming. Now there is a release when we recognize this self. There is a release and there is a freedom. And the being now is in the becoming. Being, huh? In all of the movements that we know, in all of the motions that we know, to suddenly recognize this non-movement. And in that experience, and going deeper and deeper and deeper with it, we are released from our identifications and from the absorptions in the movement. And then what we must do is to identify with the unchanging. And this is then the enjoying of immortality in this manifestation, in this becoming, without being caught on the wheel of delusion. Birth ceased. Fulfilled its purpose. Through the dissolution of the ego, the purpose fulfilled, the soul, let's call it the soul, crosses beyond death and is liberated from the dualities, from limitation. Now, having attained to this state, it accepts this whole becoming, this whole wheel, as a process of nature, see, and that it is not binding. So into this now, free and divine becoming, it enjoys immortality. This phenomenal existence is to be transcended in order that it may be freely accepted. Because this soul, even if it's, you know, we think of it as being in bondage, it is free all the time and only feels itself as being bound. It must return to this state of equilibrium in the becoming to know its freedom. Now, there was, I just want to clarify this a little. There was a couple of years ago, a seminar at Columbia University. And one of the men present said to the effect, and I've mentioned this before, only as you leave your given religion and look at it from another point of view will you understand it. And I found this to be true. I find this to be true of most anything. To be able to look at something objectively. We are born self-conscious, and we become aware of things and objects. You know, it is the most brilliant maneuver in the world, you know, that we can look at things objectively. I can look at you objectively, and I can tell you about you. I'm not objective to myself. I can't tell you anything about me. From another point of view, to look at something instead of being identified with it, to look at something objectively. You know, I'm finally beginning to understand something about Christianity. And I've come to the understanding of it through Zen koan work. The Bible's full of koan. It's marvelous, huh? And I think also because I enjoyed the Gospel of St. Thomas and St. Paul. When we step aside, as it were, from our chores and all our stuff, all this mind stuff and feeling stuff that we lug around with us, you know. When one experiences, when one slips out of that to experience a transcendent state, and then one turns to look around to see what is here, one begins to understand what is here. So I ask you, what is here? What is here? What are you identified with here? What are you not identified with here? What is here? What is objective to you here? What is here? What is here? Oh, the all-inclusive, all. And that has never been any place else except where you are. Right? Okay. I'm sorry I kept you so long. It's terrible. Don't forget to sign the card for Henry. And you can go home and look at your attachments. I can have all afternoon to do that, to think of that. And now may the peace and the power that passeth all understanding hold us and keep us in the love of the Christed consciousness while we are seemingly separate one from another. And I do thank you very much.
If you find Lola's talks valuable, more will be posted in weeks to come.